Welcome to the Mary Mack Show, where we will be talking about your feelings, experiences, and pain following the death of a loved one. Good evening, my warriors. This is Mary Mack of the Mary Mack Show, and I have the distinct privilege of being with Dr. Keith Montgomery. He lives in Oklahoma, and today we are going to discuss his daughter Leah's death. She was 30 when she died, only 2 days before her 31st birthday. She is survived by his wife, her mother, Deborah, and also her brother, Alex. Alex was three and a half years younger than Leah. And Dr. Montgomery is a dentist in Oklahoma. And I am so privileged that he is with me today. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I am interested in learning more about Leah's growing up years. Your family as a young family and how things moved forward in life?
Well, my daughter, she was born August 8, 1989, and she was just such a joy. She was just so much full of energy and fun. She never met a stranger, always happy, the kind of person who throughout life lit up the room when she walked in, and she was involved in so many things. I mean, growing up, she was obviously involved in the various athletics. She participated in softball, volleyball. She loved a great equestrian. She loved riding horses. We had horses for a while, and she was just a fun girl and everybody loved her. She had so many friends and she was really smart too. And, you know, she had a good life, growing up with both of us. She went to private school. She excelled in school. When she graduated high school, she went to University of Oklahoma. She had started a nursing program, and she had everything in the world going for her. And, you know, we used to have these big birthday parties and all the things for, you know, I sort of spoiled both of my kids, but certainly spoiled them quite a bit. You know, we'd have special birthday parties for them and do things. I mean, she was like five or six and she wanted a wedding gown. So I had a woman who made gowns make her one. And then we would do pony rides and have clowns in the parks. And then, of course, as you got older, they moved on to the swimming, taking everybody swimming and, you know, things like that. And she really enjoyed that. And she made sure everyone was involved. She wasn't a selfish person, and she stayed that way throughout her life. And she had beautiful blue eyes, curly hair. However, you know, people that have curly hair want it straight, and people that have straight hair want it curly. And so she would spend most of the morning, you know, my son would stay in bed until we had drug them out, and she'd get up 2-3 hours early to get prepped for school. And so she always wanted to look her best. Like I said, you know, private school, a good life. I mean, you know, nice home. Her home environment was wonderful. You know, we were involved in a lot of social things, and we took the kids with us everywhere. And I said, my kids have been, by the time they were 15 years old, they've been to more countries than most adults would ever go because we took them with us. I wanted them to experience the world. Traveling, I thought, was as good of an education as sitting here in a classroom.
Absolutely.
And so they really enjoyed that. She cracked me up a few times, got me a little aggravated. We were on a cruise, and I told her, do not call your friends at home. It's expensive. Halfway through the trip, then now she could view your bill. My daughter had been calling her friends every day, multiple times. My son spent the whole days in the video arcade. Their two bills together was like $2,000, about died. But I look back now, it was funny. It wasn't very funny at the moment, but
yes.
You know, they never thought anything, you know, because we took care of them and we just loved them both. And so, but Leah Marie had a good life all her life. Tons and tons of friends. I mean, from high school, junior high school, college, our friends. I mean, she just connected with everybody. She, like I said, she had the most beautiful blue eyes that would just, I mean, look like the sky. And she just was so outgoing and kind and considerate.
That's wonderful. Wow.
Great, great memories of her growing up.
Oh, that's so great. Did she finish college?
No, that's sort of when things started to change. Her granddad died suddenly on my wife's side, and it sort of set her back. They were close, you know. She'd go golfing with him and spend a lot of time, and so she just sort of got disinterested in school, trying to deal with that. So she dropped out of school for a while. And then, you know, just like so many other kids, started finding other people to hang out with, and that just started a whole process.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I say, you know, you got to pick your friends carefully, because
yes.
you become what your friends are.
Yes, what you're surrounded by.
Absolutely.
Did this lead to her addiction?
Yes, that was sort of the beginning of it. You know, I'm sure like a lot of college kids, you know, they dabble in different things. And of course, when she left college, she came back to Tulsa and stayed there. And that's when, you know, she developed some different friends. She worked in the restaurant industry as a waitress, and then I found out that there's a whole lot of that stuff going on, and certainly even the high-end restaurants, you know.
Yes.
She got a boyfriend, and he was doing drugs, and then she was started following him, and, you know, it just started spiraling out of control. And, you know, at first it was smoking pot, and then it just led to pills and different things like that. And it ultimately led to IV heroin use.
Oh, wow. That's hard.
And she got really far out there, you know. And like I said, I could not leave her alone and stranded. We had to cut some boundaries and things because we couldn't tolerate it.
Yes.
I did provide an apartment for her because I didn't want her living on the street, but it just brought in people who she had all nice things, and then part of it was she was selling for her stuff for money for drugs, and then her drug friends were stealing stuff so they could sell. And it just, that probably went on 3 to 4 years.
Wow.
And it's a very difficult thing for a parent to go through that as well, because it's not like you can tell them don't do that. They're too old. And then when they're like that, also when they're using, they're not going to listen to you on that. So it got to be a problem for us. And, my son at that time, he wasn't involved in any of that, to witness that. And it was heartbreaking to see the changes it created in her. And because she just became a different person.
Sure.
And, it took a few years for her to finally figure it out. And I think, she just finally hit her rock bottom. And one day she called and told me she needed help. And that's whenever I made the move to get her headed in the right direction. And she was
you knew
willing
she
to,
you, yes, she was ready.
She was willing to do it, because I know parents who take their kids to rehab centers. If, and some of them have been several times. I mean, it's sort of like court ordered stuff. They had to do it or go to jail. Are they really interested in quitting? Most of them, no. You've got to want to quit for a program to be effective.
Absolutely. And after she went to this rehab that you found for her, how did that work out?
Well, she called and I picked her up. And of course, she went through detox for 4 or 5 days. Then she went to the rehab program, which I think was like 90 days. And then from there, she moved into a sober living house. It was Christian based. And they had, we had always had faith in our family, and people are doing drugs. That's a father's thing from their mind.
Sure.
And so I was concerned whether she would be accepting of that, but she got in there. She resisted a little bit at first, but then found her faith, got rebaptized. She was a resident, and then she became a house manager. And ultimately, she became the executive secretary to the people that founded the program. And they're fairly big now.
Wow. That's
And
amazing.
She was there with them for 4 years. And of course, she loved the program, loved the people, loved helping these people coming in who were addicts themselves at one time, and mentoring them and coaching them. She enjoyed that, but she wanted to go back to school. And being a faith-based program, they had meetings at night, AA meetings and their house meetings, and then church on Sunday, activities on the weekend. So she was having a hard time being able to take classes and work. So she finally decided that she was going to leave that job and take a different job and essentially try to get back into the nursing program. And so she ended up taking a job, because she had worked for me when she was young in my office. So she had learned all these skills of being a receptionist and insurance and all those things. So she found a job easily at a dental office here in Oklahoma City and went to work for them. And unfortunately, she was only there 7 weeks before she died. But somewhere along the way, a coworker she met who was doing drugs and who's the one who decided to take her out 2 nights before her birthday to celebrate. And she's the one that gave her the pill that killed her. And they both took it. They both passed out, obviously. But she came to and my daughter was not breathing. Luckily, she called 911. However, it was too late.
Tell me, did they take the same pill and break it in half? Or did they take individual pills?
That I'm not for sure of. I know they both went into the bathroom. Now, it's my understanding that maybe they crushed it, and I'm not sure whether, because I'm not familiar with all the ways that people do drugs, but I'm pretty sure they crushed it up, and I'm not sure if they snorted it or smoked it or if they swallowed it.
Gotcha. Because you know how sometimes in this community we talk about how there's the chocolate chip cookie effect, where you can split a pill in half and one part of the cookie or the pill has all the fentanyl in it and the other side doesn't. And this way one person stays alive and the other person does not.
Well, this girl had a history of drugs and fentanyl abuse. So I think her tolerance level obviously was probably a little higher.
Okay.
My daughter had not done any drugs in 4 years. Plus, she had gastric bypass surgery and had lost a lot of weight. I think that was a factor into the blood level. I want to say her blood level was like not her 5 nanograms of fentanyl, which is still pretty high.
Yes, definitely.
Lethal dose, obviously. But I think the other girl, she, like I said, she had passed out. She came to, but they took it at the apartment where this guy lived and went and got in the car, and they never made it out of the parking lot. So that's how fast it worked.
Oof. Oh my God.
But then, you know, we get the call about 10:30 from the hospital that she is at the hospital and that she is deceased. So we do go down to the emergency room. They had a room set aside where we could go in and see her that one last time. And it was hard.
Absolutely.
Seeing your child on the table, dead, and knowing you'll never, ever get to see him, talk to him, hug him ever again. And I will tell you, for weeks, she would always come by the house and come in through the back door. And I can tell you the longest time I'd hear that door and I would turn around expecting to see her walk in. And that took forever to finally realize that wasn't happening. But it's one of those things that I never, ever in my life thought I would have to experience. And I would never wish that off on my worst enemy, because it's an experience that just literally rips your heart out. There's no other way that I can explain it. And it takes a long time to try to put those pieces back together.
Certainly
it's like a like a broken glass. There are little pieces that are broken. You'll never find them, because you'll never have a whole heart.
You don't expect to bury a child. No one does.
No. It was the worst day, too. I mean, the day of finding out that night was terrible. But planning a funeral, you don't even know where to start.
No. No.
Thank God the funeral director helped. But then we had to sit down and write the obituary. Hard, hard, hard.
Yes.
And you want to make sure it's right. You want to try to tell everything, but you worry you leave something out. And it's sort of like you got one shot at it.
True.
The day of the funeral, the church, or excuse me, we had it at the funeral, but they had a big reception area. It was big. It was packed, standing room, and people waiting outside. I would say probably 300 to 400 people. So it just showed us how many people really loved her. It was a tough day.
I'm sure.
And then the weeks after, sleeping is hard. I couldn't sleep. I was exhausted, but I couldn't sleep. And
Yes.
so I went to my primary care doctor. He gave me some sleeping pills, Ambien. I took those one night. I was like, I can't. Next day, I felt drugged out all day. And I said, I can't do this. But
Yes.
one thing that he did say, he goes, you know as well as I know, there's no pill that's going to fix this. You have to fix it. He's so right. And it takes a while. It takes a while. I'm still working on it.
Yes. Yeah.
I try to inform as many people as I can. I'm in a good situation being at the office, but seeing patients. But I've had patients have lost children or family members. And I've said at some point, somebody, you will know somebody, whether related, friend, family, whatever, that has lost somebody to fentanyl. You will, because it's so prevalent today.
People don't want to believe that, but it's so true.
It's just, I've been probably 10 or 12 funerals myself last couple of years. People that I knew, and then I hear people all the time. I'm in two support groups, and they post new members, and every day it's a heartbreaking story. Somebody losing their child or brother or sister. And it's really heartbreaking when I see some of these people who had the unfortunate experience of losing one, but who have lost two or three family members, children.
Yes, it's unfathomable, and you can't wrap your head around that.
Like with my son, he went through addiction 2, 3 months after my daughter started the program. He started, but it really worried me after my daughter died because he was at his low point. And I was so worried that he would fall back into that addiction. But I honestly, my wife and him talked about it. I don't know what we would do if we lost both kids.
Sure.
I mean, your reason for living is now gone. And so I talked to him, continued to talk to him, and I always thought, well, you see what happened to your sister? You would think a sibling wouldn't go there, but it happens. It happens. But he is still doing well, goes to the church events and in support groups, has lots of friends that provide support from the program. It's doing extremely well.
Oh, that's so
But
good.
it is scary. When you lose one, you worry about the others.
Without a doubt. Will you take us to the criminal justice side of your daughter's death?
Well, the day that my daughter died, of course, like I said, her saving grace, she called 911, but then the paramedics and fire department, police got there, and obviously they knew what happened. So they arrested the girl that was with her, and she spent that night in jail and then bonded out the next day. However, the police interviewed her. She gave up her phone. They had my daughter's phone. And at first, she is her story kept changing. And she bonded out, but the detectives had talked to her, and he said, I don't the detective told me you had a come to Jesus moment. He told her, he said, you gotta tell us what's going on, the real thing. Because you're facing some serious issues. Serious. And she was a previous felon. She had contributed to a cousin's death.
Oh
She
my
had dealt drugs.
God.
She had her kids taken away because she would stop at somebody's house and go in and do drugs and leave her little kids in the car.
Oh my gosh.
So she was not the good person. And it just is unfortunate. She had that job at that office that nobody knew that. She should have never been hired, in my opinion. I mean, I wouldn't hire somebody like that. I don't think anybody would, but nobody knew it. But so the detectives told them, told her she needed to get her act together, and her she's facing some serious, issues. So she ended up turning state's evidence. Her saving grace, like I said, was calling 911. Had she not called 911, she would be in prison along with the guy. But she turned the state's evidence. They set up a sting. He was selling drugs like he's done all of his life, long history, in and out of jail, in and out of prison. He had only been out of prison 3 or 4 months for drug charges
Oh my goodness.
before my daughter died. Short period of time. He never changed his ways. But
Like
they
you
set up
said
the
before,
sting.
those kind of people don't change their ways.
Oh, that's the only way they know how to make a living. And they're not really making money. They just provide enough money so they can do their drugs as well. But they caught him with drugs. He was arrested. They interviewed him. He bonded out the next day, and then they ended up on some other stuff that they rearrested him and put a bond up, a little bit higher bond, but he bonded out on that. And then had a grand jury hearing, and so they had brought him in and had questioned him, questioned the girl. So they had a date set for the grand jury. Well, she didn't show up for the first grand jury hearing. So I don't guess she thought
Wasn't
it was
very
important.
smart.
And unfortunately, like I said, the judge's son had died just a couple of months earlier from fentanyl. So he was not happy. And he made the police go get her that day and bring the courtroom. And he told her, young lady, you don't understand what's going on here. And he said, I expect you to be here next month because we're going to have another hearing. And otherwise, if you're not here, you'll be spending a year in jail. And he said, when you get here, he said, actually, I want you here 15 minutes early. So she was there for the next one. But so they had the grand jury hearing, and he was indicted, first degree murder. And so then they arrested him then, and they changed the bond to a $300,000 cash bond, which
Excellent.
means you got to have $300,000 yourself. So he wasn't going anywhere. And he sat probably a year or so in the county jail. And we were supposed to have several different preliminary hearings, and they kept getting postponed. And so it finally come down to where I think we're getting ready to maybe do a trial. And that's when his lawyer met with the DA and they decided they would do a plea deal. They had initially charged him with first degree murder. And so was a state attorney general that prosecuted my daughter's case. It's one of the first ones where they really went after the dealer with murder charges. And we're seeing that more and more in other here in Oklahoma as well as in other states. Like,
Yes.
they're going after people now. And so dealers beware. Somebody dies with your drugs, you're going to be held accountable. But he ended up doing a plea deal and he got 20 years. He pled guilty to second degree murder.
Okay.
So part of his plea deal, they had a call it a 12 and 8 program. So we would do 12 years and eight on probation. On the 12 years since he pled guilty, he has to serve 85% of that 12, which comes out to about 10.2 years or something like that. So he'll serve that 10 plus years and then he gets out. However, he gets a traffic stop. Well, maybe not that, but if he gets into any kind of trouble, small, it don't have to be big, because of that plea deal, he will have to go back and serve those full 8 years. With his past history, career-long drug dealer, criminal, I just don't envision him changing his ways now. So he will end up serving 18 of the 20.
Good.
Now, I feel fortunate because luckily we had a suspect that they were able to prove who provided it and charged him with her death. So we got justice. We got eternity for our life of not having our daughter, but we got some degree of justice. I wish it could have been more, but we got justice because, like the judge at the grand jury hearing, his son had died. They found him on the side of the building. They never knew where the drugs came from. So he had no justice. And I know lots of people who, unfortunately, they don't know where they got it, nothing to link it to. So they never get to charge a person that's responsible for the death. They may know who did it, but they don't have the direct evidence to link them.
Right.
So I feel fortunate. Like I said, I wish he could have got more, but we did get some degree of justice.
Somebody's paying for it.
Right.
I'm glad for you. I'm
I
glad for you.
would.
I know it's not as much as you would have liked, but I'm really glad you got something.
Yes, I feel blessed because, like I said, I know plenty of people who didn't get any justice
Yes.
and never will get justice.
Yes.
But, for us, we were given the option of going to a jury trial. But, this was sort of new. This was in 2021. New for our state. And the attorney general said, you can roll the dice here. This is sort of iffy grounds and whatever. And, who's to say the guy could walk?
Yes.
A free man. What do you want? And then the other thing he brought up, he said, if it goes to trial, I just need to inform you, it's going to be a rough trial because they are going to make your daughter look like pure trash.
Yes.
And are you prepared for that? And me, myself, my wife, we really did want that to be an issue. because that wasn't her. So going through a jury trial has its pros and cons. You know, you're going to hear the worst of the worst, and you are taking a roll of the dice. So a plea deal for us was good.
Makes sense at that point. I'm glad that they at least offered you that, you know, they had the ability to offer you that. And it was substantial. It's not like a slap on the hand and we're given probation for 3 years. No, they really gave him jail time, prison time.
Yeah, you know, I would never write to him, but I'd just be curious, you know, what's he doing in prison? Does he remember what he did? Those kind of things. If you wrote, he probably wouldn't tell you anyway, or the truth. But
right.
I don't want to talk to him myself, because I still have resentment towards him.
Sure, that's understandable. And how do you even know that he would write you back? You know,
that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Or write you back something you don't want to hear.
Yes. Yes.
But
so
no, it's I'm just glad things happened the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
So I have faith in the judicial system. For me it worked, but for others it doesn't work.
True.
They don't pursue. Sometimes they don't pursue unless a family really pushes the issue. And I'm not for sure why that is. If it's just they're overwhelmed and these cases are on the fringe or what, or they got feel like they got something more important to deal with, but it worked for us.
I'm glad. But you're right, there are other families who they didn't do enough of an investigation when it first happened. So they don't have the phone with, you know, the communication between the dealer or the communication between, like in your case with that other girl. So they don't have enough evidence. And if they had done an investigation initially, all of that could have been captured, held on to. You know, maybe it didn't go to court right away, but at least you have it, you know,
right.
Then you can get it. Then you can keep pressing for another detective to pick it up and run with it.
Right. Yeah, you got to have the evidence early on, because you
Very
don't
early.
capture, you don't get it then. It gets lost.
That's right. It is. You know,
and
years ago, like when your daughter was killed, at that point, they didn't really consider, they just considered it an overdose, right? They didn't consider it a murder.
Another drug addict.
Right.
Another drug addict.
Exactly. And they just kind of swept it away under the, you know, table or the rug, whatever you want to say. And they didn't do what they should have done, you know. And unfortunately, those early families, they just didn't know that they could push for it. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And now the newer families, unfortunately, are learning that through advocacy work, like what you've done and other parents have done to help the newbies, so to speak, you know, the newer families. So would you tell us, because I know that you've gone out and you've spoken to different events and to junior and high school and college people. And tell us your experience with that and how you decided to start doing that.
Well, I have had the privilege of a member of a couple of support groups. And then people at that time, it's sort of like the word gets out. And of course, you know, two or three of the TV stations after my daughter died interviewed me, because fentanyl was just sort of coming about, you know. And then just, I probably think what also helped is just with my occupation, my career, knowing the people that I do, also just being outspoken and willing to participate has given me those opportunities. And like I said, I'm in a couple of support groups, but I've been asked to speak, sit on these panels, and we speak to, high school kids, college kids, junior high kids, and bring fentanyl awareness. We're taking even Narcan to these events and passing it out for free. But, I speak on the behalf of a parent who's lost a child. There's like five or six people that sit on these panels. And, I tell people, you want to believe your kids are doing the right thing, but, sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees. And you love your kids so much, you can't imagine they would be doing that. So you don't want to believe it. They're doing it.
Very true.
You got to be aware. But here's the risk. If you do it, you got to have these talks with these kids, because they don't get it. I mean, I said, some of these kids, well, my dealer would never deal in that. They're all getting it from the same place. These dealers aren't making it themselves. They're playing Russian roulette. And so I sit on these panels, and they're the group of us, everything from a judge to a counselor, psychologist, myself, and a detective, maybe a nurse in the ER, just different ones. And we're telling them our stories. And hopefully that somebody, if you don't listen to one, maybe you'll listen to one of the others. But getting that out there, because I'm still shocked. Even today, if I tell people in my office about fentanyl, it's like the first time they've heard it. And so, like spring break was here, and I had several young kids who were going to Mexico for spring break. It didn't bother me one bit. I told everyone, those kids, I said, let me tell you something. My daughter died from fentanyl. You're going to be on spring break partying. I'm not stupid. And you may try something. But let me tell you what. You can try something. It could potentially kill you. You have no business taking any kind of stuff from a stranger or a friend unless it's 100% pharmaceutical.
Right. Came in a prescription that was written for you.
For you. Yeah. And so, I tell parents, talk to your kids. I tell kids, this is what happened to my daughter. And like I said, I'm shocked that there's so many people who haven't heard about it, but we're hearing more, a little bit more on the news, obviously. Certainly when celebrities die or family members die, I mean, you pretty much anymore, if you're young and you died, you pretty much know what they died from. And so that is helping get it out there. Just the attention that it's getting from the news media, certain groups. And it's still, I think some segments of certain medias, they certainly filter through, and they're only telling you what they want you to know and not always the truth about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you see more talk about it, but there needs to be a whole lot more. But, we have large groups now that are going to the Capitol once or twice a year, and it's events like that that help spread that out and gets people more aware than sitting waiting on the news media to tell you.
Yes, absolutely. How have you been up to the capital of Oklahoma? Have you visited with the senators, and is it assemblymen or representatives?
It's senators and representatives. Okay. And so, yes, I have talked to them, given my side of the story. And, we have 77 counties, and, our two big counties, Tulsa and Oklahoma City, and the rest of them are poor counties. obviously high drug use, low socioeconomic, low education. But it's I think they're becoming more in tune to it, and I would love to see them, and it's an effort that I'll continue to push to try to get some type of laws on the bill to for certain of these people involved in these things to have a mandatory time, prison time. And repeat offenders, no such thing as repeat. And if we get these people off the street, get the drugs off the street, we're saving lives every single day.
Absolutely.
And you see these reports nowadays of confiscating pounds of pure fentanyl, thousands of pills that are laced with fentanyl, thousands. Those are the ones that are getting caught. Let's think about how many get across the border that are not caught. Way more than the ones that are getting caught. So it's flooding the market, and you're playing with Russian roulette when you take any kind of drug that, like I said, wasn't prescribed for you by a doctor that you got at a pharmacy. And I had a colleague of mine, just the marijuana. People think marijuana, because we have medical marijuana in our state, and people think, oh, it's not that bad. It's not going to hurt you. It ain't going to kill you. Well, one of my dental colleagues, her son was smoking pot laced with fentanyl, and he died. 17 years old.
I had a guest a number of months ago from Rhode Island. Same thing happened to her son, laced with fentanyl, and he died.
It's in everything. We had a friend of ours was getting married. Their daughter, this was 2 or 3 years ago, she was nervous. She's getting married right before Christmas, and it was a couple of days before a wedding. She's really anxious and nervous. Somebody gave her a Xanax. Killed her.
Oh my God.
She wasn't a druggie either. Somebody thought they were helping her.
Sure.
Here's a Xanax. But, here in Oklahoma, when they confiscate some of these pills, they test them, and 1 in 4 have fatal doses of fentanyl. And the other thing that people do not realize how minuscule amount of fentanyl will kill you.
Just a few little grams.
Well, 5 grains of salt, table salt, will be a lethal dose. Contact policemen. Nowadays, I was watching that at the border when they're intercepting these products and they suspect fentanyl. They'd put them in these glass containers like the scientific labs with a leather glove, because breathing it, touching it will kill you.
Yes.
It is that potent and dangerous.
And the other thing that they're doing, the other thing they're doing is they're lacing it with like xylazine, which is a drug that they give to animals.
Right.
And also something called carfentanil, which is 100 times more potent than fentanyl.
Right.
And I think to myself, where do they get this stuff?
Well, they manufacture it.
Yeah,
a good chemist. But here's the thing, like with the xylazine, it's not an opioid. It's a horse tranquilizer. So Narcan does not work on it. Narcan only works on opioids.
Yep, but it doesn't work on fentanyl either.
So if you overdose on that, you're done.
Yeah.
You can't be revived with a reversal drug.
Yes.
And it's just scary where we are today with these type of drugs. And it's
Yes.
like, why do we need them? But it makes them more potent, more stronger. And people, I mean, there are people who do fentanyl, I mean, outright fentanyl, but their tolerance to it, because they've gotten so used to doing it, is high, but anybody else, it'd kill them. So it is a very, very dangerous drug.
Yes. And if you are a person who is accustomed to doing drugs and you build up your tolerance, I mean, the chances of you coming back to normal society is very, very slim.
Right.
You're the people who are on the side of the street homeless, and all you live for is that next high, and that's what's so sad.
And that's part of the problem. We see the homelessness here in America on the increase. It's not necessarily home. They're homeless, all right, but they're a lot of them are drug addicts. Mental
Yes.
health and drug addicts. And it, with the drug use increasing, this is what happens.
Yes. And what I think about is there's not enough mental health advocates or situations where these people can go to.
No, right.
Most of them don't have insurance. They have no way of going into some kind of program, even if they want to. And the chances of them recovering are so slim.
These
And that, oh,
the treatment programs are very expensive.
yes.
And some insurance will pay for them, some of them won't.
Right.
And it's a big burden for a family to do that.
Yes.
And then especially what happens when the first one fails, the second one fails, the third one fails. At what point do you go, I can't send you anymore.
There's no money left for this.
There's no money left. I had a physician I knew in Tulsa. They spent $100,000 on multiple treatment programs for their son. And he had to finally say, enough, enough is enough. Because it was
Yes.
never ending.
Right.
And, like I said, until a person is willing to accept treatment, forced treatment is never going to work.
I agree. You have to want to. You have to
Right.
want to have a recovery.
Both my kids reached that point where essentially they were at the end of their rope, and they both reached out and begged for help. And they benefited from it because they wanted it,
Yes.
not because somebody else wanted to do it or the court made them do it. They wanted it. And it worked for
It worked for both of your children.
them.
I'd like to thank Dr. Montgomery for sharing his beautiful daughter's life with us, Leah Marie Montgomery. Please subscribe, rate, review, like, share, especially so that we will be lifted up in the algorithms for more people to see. Have a wonderful week ahead. We'll see you again soon.